In fellowship, and let's continue on now. We are ready to dive in to verse 1 here, having set up sort of the background of this, the showdown that's about to happen. And of course, as we're going to see, Jesus not only bests these people, they're trying to humiliate him publicly, causing him to lose face before the masses, whom they, unfortunately, the religious leadership is misguided. They really believe the people are all behind Jesus, which they're not. But they're worried about the crowds, of course, as we know. They feared the crowds, as seen in their refusal to answer the question about John the Baptist. And, of course, in his question, it was brilliant because certainly there's no doubt that John the Baptist's ministry was designed to point to Christ. So if one accepted John, he essentially was logically forced into having to accept Christ. And this shows the illogical nature of, say, John's disciples, who remained his disciples after even after the death of Christ, even. So, Jesus is now not only going to answer them, he's already bested them once. He's going to tell this parable, which is designed to publicly humiliate them. And he's going to beat these people, but essentially now, it's no longer just, I'm going to take this, or I'm going to avoid it. It's, I'm bringing the fight to you now. And I'm bringing the fight to you in the temple precincts. We're playing on your home field. So, and I am going to beat you and beat you soundly. And when I do, all the people are going to know that you've been bested. And so, here in verse 1, now continuing, and again, the chapter division here is sort of unfortunate because this very much follows on the heels of that confrontation about John the Baptist and authority. And he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the wine press and built a tower. And is Chi, you've got the aorist, middle indicative of arco, the verb to begin or to initiate something, A-R-C-H-O, to start or to begin, to them. Again, the near antecedent is the religious leaders back in 1127. In, preposition in here with the locative feminine plural of our term parabole. P-A-R-A-B-O-L-E. Parabole, again, parable, literally a throwing alongside. To tell a story in basically normal earthly terms, which conveys a larger meaning, a spiritual meaning. Although, basically, it is a common story told in everyday terms that everybody understands. And yet there's greater significance to it. And he began to speak. You've got the complementary infinitive here of laleo, completes the thought of arco. He began to speak. A vineyard. Ampelon is the A-M-P-E-L-O-N. Ampelon. A vineyard, a place for cultivating grapevines. A vineyard, a man, again, very much here in the generic character of parables, you do not have, you know, it might say a certain man, but it's very generic here, a man, anthropos, planted, aorist active indicative of futuo, a P-H-U, a T-E-U-O, and that simply means that, to plant. A man planted, and you got the accusative, a vineyard, essentially. You got the nominative singular here. A man planted a vineyard. And you'll see in the text here, the words a man are in lowercase, whereas the what follows it is a direct citation out of Isaiah. So a man planted a vineyard and Chi put a wall around it. Peritithemi is the verb, a P-E-R-I. T-I-T-H-E-M-I. Tithemi means to set, place, or put. Peri has the idea of an enclosure, to put something around something. And so they've built around it, literally. Eight times peri, tithemi is used. Phragmos, which is an accusative masculine singular, P-H-R-A-G-M-O-S. Four times, this is something that is used to enclose a particular area, a wall, a partition, a fence, or a hedge. So he built a wall around it, and dug a vat under the wine press. And is chi. Then you have this verb, oruso, O-R-U-S-S-O, only used three times, to dig or to dig a hole. And then you have under this, hupolenion, H-U-P-O-L-E-N-I-O-N, only used one time. This is unique to Mark. And this is a vessel that's placed under a press. Now, the press could be a wine press, olive press, whatever they might want to derive juice from. It is normally recessed into a hole in the ground. They would construct a vat, very often made out of rock, by the way. But it was recessed, and there was a hole in the ground, and then, of course, it was designed. It would run down, and the juice would run down into it, and then it would go into a collection area. So he dug a vat, hupolenion, and under the wine press, again, this is the vat itself, dug a vat, and built a tower. Oikodomeo is the term. This is O-I-K-E-O-D-O-M-E-O. Comes from the word house. It's O-I-K-O. Sorry, there's no epsilon in there. D-O-M-E-O. This means to erect a building. Comes from didymi, literally to give a house, hence to build something, to construct something. And he constructed a pergos, a P-U-R-G-O-S, used only four times. This is a tall fortified structure occupied by a watchman, and it was used to look in every direction. It was a form of protection. It was your lookout tower, essentially. That's the biggest reason it was there, was to watch for approaching enemies. And he rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. And is chi here, he rented it out, is ekdidomi, literally to give away from, to give over to. E-K-D-I-D-O-M-I, ekdidomi. Four times, and it's only used in the middle voice, because clearly he's doing it in his own interest. He's not merely just renting it out, but he's going to get payment back for it. He's participating in the rental process for a reason, or the leasing process. So to rent out the vineyard is autos it, accusative masculine singular, refers back to the accusative ampelon, vineyard. The whole thing, not just one particular part of it, but this whole complex. First, one of the things that stands out here is the man was thorough and diligent. I mean, when he prepared this thing and he put tenants in it, it was ready to go. This was not a slipshod operation. This was done very well. I mean, the guy was very diligent and very thorough about all of this. The vine growers literally walked into a turnkey situation. And all they had to do, again, we'll get into this and the various kinds of contracts that they could have, but essentially all they had to do was send him his share of the proceeds once it started bearing fruit. And very often that was done, that was 3 or 4 years in the future. There was an understanding in most productions, and still today people recognize this, that if you start a business, if you make any money, if you actually have a profit before the third or fourth year, you're doing good. Well, this was technically true in the agricultural society of Israel as well. So he rented out or leased out it to Georgos. We get our word George from this. And it literally means one who does agricultural work. G-E-O-R-G-O-S, a farmer. Now, it can be the one who owns the farm, obviously. But in this case, these are leasers. These are tenant farmers. They're not the ones who built it or who own it. And went on a journey. And is chi, and then apo de meo is the verb 6 times it's used. Means to travel away from home, to go on a journey. It's interesting that this term is only used in parables. So it's a pretty generic term about traveling off. Doesn't say where he went, how far he went, how long he went. Doesn't give you any of that information. It would appear from, as we get into the parable here, you're going to see that he was at some distance. He wasn't just in their vicinity. That he'd gone off quite a ways. Maybe, who knows? I mean, maybe he set this up. This was his retirement income, and he went off to retire in Shangri-La. We don't really know what the situation was. One of the things that is clear was that he was a man of some means. You don't just do all this and have this set up, this turnkey operation. And again, it wasn't slipshod. It was done thoroughly. And so we know that about him. So maybe he went off to retire and live off of the proceeds that he's going to get from this. Well, I mean, we're really not ever told. Well, point one, as mentioned in the introduction, Jesus continued his habit of teaching in parables, which is designed to veil the truth to those that are negative and cause those that are positive to think through the analogy, to put the things together, to take the details and particulars and sort them out and understand them. Two, there is no indication about whether or not Jesus had been teaching in a more direct fashion to the crowds. But with the arrival of the delegation from the Sanhedrin, he immediately uses the parabolic format. My suspicion is he's still teaching largely in parables to the crowds. While the religious leadership's fooled by the crowds and their apparent loyalty to Jesus, Jesus isn't fooled. Jesus knows what they are. I believe it's in the Gospel of John where it says, nobody needed to tell him about what was in man because he knew all men. So he knew what the crowds were. So my guess is this is consistent with what he's been doing and what he still does. So there's nothing in that sense unusual here. Be it as evident that the chapter breaks are artificial in these books and that this parable is immediately connected with the events of chapter 11. In fact, the parable speaks directly to the matter of authority. So it was clear that during times of conflict, Jesus would use parables to communicate. The conflict here relates to Jesus' direct and indirect claims of authority. Now, again, how much they thought, I think largely they were focusing on his actions in the temple. By whose authority or by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority? And that would have been the preceding day, the events of cleansing the court of the Gentiles, which he had done 3 years previous. I don't know that there's so much focusing on the, quote, triumphal entry. I'm sure they heard about it. But that was largely a function of the crowds. That wasn't really Jesus sort of manifesting authority in some way. That was really mostly the crowd. It seemed, as we pointed that out when we were coming in there, that this all seems very spontaneous. I mean, it's not as though this is engineered. So I don't think they're messing with that nearly as much as their deal is, where do you get the authority to come into the temple and do these things? With his last exchange, point five, Jesus Christ made it clear he was not going to answer their question about the source of his authority. However, those listening would have to draw their own conclusions about Jesus Christ. Six, this parable is addressed to an unspecified group, to them, which refers back to the group that confronted Jesus in the temple in 11:27. Seven, the three groups that are mentioned there form the three fundamental bodies that are represented on the Sanhedrin. So thus, this group represented the religious leadership of the nation, albeit in a sort of a committee form. But essentially, they are sent by the big Sanhedrin, and they're their delegation, they're their representatives. Nine, both Matthew and Mark indicate that the parable was addressed to the representatives of the Sanhedrin, while Luke states that it was addressed to the people. Well, the reality is both are true. I mean, primarily the parable is directed at them. But you've got all these crowds around. What, so we suppose they didn't hear it? That somehow this just, no, it's not. They're both true. And he began to tell the people this parable. Luke says it was addressed to the people. Mark says it was addressed to the Sanhedrin representatives. Well, they both heard it. Nine, given Jesus' position in the court of the Gentiles, it should not be considered unusual that he wanted all those that could to hear his teaching. However, it is very clearly his intention to embarrass the religious leaders and expose them for what they are. Now, these men want to come out in public and you want a showdown. Well, if you want to pull down your pants in public, Jesus is going to let you. And in fact, he may help you. And you're just going to look foolish. But these men are arrogant. They don't care. They don't even see how stupid they look. I've observed this in negative volition too. They'll pull some of the most incredible stunts and never even see that it's just the stupidest thing you've ever seen. That's just what astonishes me. Well, and 10, in the culture of honor / shame, these men have attempted to discredit Jesus before the masses and bring him to shame. However, he will completely turn the tables on them and dishonor them before those they sought to impress. And 11, although Mark records only one parable here, it is clear from the plural parables, as well as what is recorded in other accounts, that this was only one among several parables Jesus taught on Wednesday. And where we are in the day is hard to tell, but I know that by the end of chapter 12, we pretty much are closing in on the end of the day. They are getting ready as they're departing the temple. This is when they're going to get this final message, which unfortunately for them in chapter 13 is not a pleasant one. Well, 12, although some interpreters want to make the phrase en parabolēs, in with or by parable, strictly adverbial, the plural is significant and does indicate more than one parable. This is their way of getting around this. They try to reconcile, well, Mark only mentions one parable, so clearly the plural here doesn't mean parables. Yeah, it does. But they want to try to twist it in. And it's not that though this could not never be used adverbially, it could. But essentially they would twist this to read, he was speaking parabolically. Well, he was, but he used more than one parable is the point here. 13, the language of the parable clearly reflects the Septuagint of Isaiah 5. That's the Greek version of the Hebrew. That's the Greek translation of the Hebrew version. And the Song of the Vineyard, which anyone with any familiarity with Isaiah would have recognized immediately. And 14, as mentioned previously, the context first deals with the destruction of Israel for its negative volition and lack of divine good production. In Isaiah, the problem lay with the vineyard itself. But in this parable, the farmers are at fault. And 15, in order to grasp all that is here, it's important to know that this practice of absentee landowners in Israel was widespread. First, what he's doing here is he's talking about a situation that existed pretty regularly in society at that time. And when you have these rich absentee landowners, and you have a relatively poor indigenous populace, well, guess what? The rich people aren't popular with the poor people. Shock, shock. So there was a sort of inherent bias against the rich landowners by the poor people in Israel, even though they profited from this system in which these rich landowners would lease out their property and let the farmers run it, the tenants run it, and then they just shared in the produce. And there were a number of types of contracts they would have, just as you can probably set up similar things today. And depending upon what you want out of it, you set up the contract accordingly. So again, this was widespread. It was not particularly liked by the masses, and formed the basis for some volatile encounters. 16, it was not uncommon in Israel for a wealthy landowner to buy a tract of land, invest in improvements, and then rent it out to tenant farmers who would share its production with the owner. So again, what you see here is the parable expresses a regular feature of society at that time. And we still have tenants and landowners here. It's not as though we don't have this at this point in time. It's not just done in terms of the agricultural situation as much. Most people who are in agriculture today in America are there because they're farmers and they want to be there. That's not to say that there aren't people. I remember my great aunt and my great uncle, my aunt and uncle actually it was. They were working. They worked on a farm and ran this particular farm for this guy in Kansas one time, I remember. And their job was to, you know, take care of it and all that and report to the landowner and whatever they had to pay or whatever. But they got to live there for free. That's another whole thing. These tenants essentially are living there. They're taking this over, this turnkey operation. They're walking into it for free. And they have several years in order to make this effective and productive and profitable. It's not as though the landowner said, okay, yeah, I'm going to move you in here. I'm charging you a lot of money to move in, and then you're going to have to pay X amount this year, this year, this year. Typically, the understanding was it took some time to produce crops and make a profit. So in all of this situation, again, this is very common. So 17, in fact, this was very familiar to those living in the first century, where much of the land was held by large estates and rented out. Rather than being farmed by the owner, it was even more common in Galilee than in Judea. In 18, this type of arrangement had become more popular, and had escalated under the Herodian family rule. This had led to an increase in Jews that did not own their own land, and had resulted in a significant amount of resentment among the people. Well, in some ways, you know, I don't know how you feel, but essentially, you know, there's two kinds of people in Sarasota. There's us that work to support the rich that have retired here. We do their lawns, we do their pools, we do their books. You have the core sort of working class. Now, I don't have any animosity about that. I mean, if I need a part-time job or a full-time job and this all works out, okay, well, they're not the highest paying jobs in the world, though. We have to acknowledge that. I mean, I wouldn't want to have to live on $8 or $9 an hour. Well, I don't know that you could. At one time in Sarasota, you couldn't have. You may be able to squeak by now. But even many of those are on government assistance and welfare and other factors that are supplementing their income. Well, some people really resent this. I don't tend to be one of the ones that resents it because, frankly, number one, there's nothing new under the sun. This had been going on in human history from the beginning, probably. As soon as people began to develop and own land, and that became a factor. So this is not new. And as long as the arrangement is fair, or at least, you know, hopefully reasonably fair, I don't have any problem with the whole deal. But you can also see that, and I've seen this before, that, you know, poor people or people who have to work for a living and who struggle resent those at some level that don't. Well, they shouldn't. That's just STA activity. That's just petty jealousy. Hey, I don't care if you're rich. Doesn't matter to me. My prayer for all believers is they'll prosper and be in good health even as their soul prospers. So if God blesses you with a lot, I'm fine with it. I don't care. And it doesn't bother me that there are people in Sarasota that own more have spent more money on a boat than I'll spend in my entire life. You think, well, that could be irritating. It's not to me. If they don't have a boat, nah, I don't care. How does that hurt me? It doesn't hurt me. And if they need their pool cleaned and I'm a pool boy, well, it might work to my benefit. Well, 19, this type of investment, again, was significant. It required a large amount of capital from which the landowner was expecting a sizable financial return. Anybody that invests in anything has a reasonable expectation of a financial return on investment. They call it today your ROI. And they'll, you know, some things, you know, if you get really into financial planning and all of that, they'll have these elaborate charts to show you what your ROI should be if you're going to be successful and all that. Well, again, these people are fronting the money. They're doing all the work. They're putting up. So do they have a reasonable expectation of return? Yes. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the system as such. Were there abuses? Sure. But aren't there abuses in every system? So we'd have to throw out every system if we're going to just base it on are there abuses in it. Well, thus, point 20, this was not designed for the benefit of the tenants. Shock, shock. If you come out to Railside, where I work, or any park, if you go to rent industrial space, if you read the contract, or if you sign a lease, believe me, when I tell you it is written in favor of the landlord, everything in it is in the landlord's favor. And if you don't want to rent the space, that's your business. But it's all leading toward the landlord. In other words, we have things in there like, if the building blows over, we're not responsible. If your neighbor next door leaves his water on and floods your unit, we're not responsible. We're not responsible. If your lights go out, you got to fix them. Now, we are responsible for certain major things. If your garage door messes up, we'll fix that for you because that's a big job. And you may need a professional. Major plumbing problems in the park, we take care of. But really, the thing is, you can't have pets. And there's all this you can't in it. And there's all this we can. And it's slanted towards the landlord. And that was true today, and it's true in this case. So 20, it was not designed for the benefit of the tenants, but for the commercial advantage of the landowner. Now, this does not mean that the tenants did not profit from their labors. Most of the people out there that rent space, and probably in all sort of industrial park situations, if they're in business, this is a part of their cost of doing business, but if they're not profiting where they are, do you think they're going to stay there? No. Like, you know, you've got to have X amount of income or whatever to pay the bills and all that. So, again, the tenants did profit, but that certainly, again, was not the focus of the landowner. Did he want them to be successful? Sure. I'd like everybody in our park to be successful so they'll rent more space. That's it. That's it. Do I personally care about their prosperity? No, not at all. Only to the extent that it affects the landowner. And that is, you know, that's just the way the world works. Well, 21, by the time Jesus uttered this parable, the passage in Isaiah had been allegorized by Jewish interpreters. Shock, shock. They identified the tower as the temple and the wine vat as the altar. You gotta love creative exegesis. I mean, just... Huh. Well, 22, as with all literal, historical, and grammatical interpretation, the exegete must seek the literal first. If it makes sense, there is no reason to seek some deeper esoteric meaning. 23, thus, the wall the owner built around it was exactly that, a wall. The purpose of the wall was protection from animals, impeding people that might use the vineyard as a shortcut, and protecting the crops from thieves. So the wall was there. It was a literal wall. It had a literal function. The literal function was protection. And sometimes they would use hedges, a series of elaborate hedges that were difficult to get through that animals wouldn't try to go through. And then typically if small animals aren't going to try to go through it, humans aren't. I mean, they would weave them together if you ever go out and see the mangroves and you see them and how they're, you know, try walking through those. I mean, I've watched some of these survival shows where they walk, they get in and get stuck in the mud in the mangroves. Oh, that's nasty. You don't want to be there. Well, they would use these elaborate hedges. So when you hear hedges, don't think ornamental hedges. They were protective hedges. Thus it was a wall. Mark does not specify, point 24, what sort of protective fence the landowner used. But often it could be nothing more than a hedge that was about 10 hands high. It was not always impenetrable, but served as a real deterrent to anyone that should not be in the vineyard. It didn't, you know, it was one of those things where it just behooved you to go around. You didn't want to mess with it necessarily. It might have thorns and briars in it. People would construct hedges out of that. That's referenced even back in the Old Testament, say in Hosea, about I will hedge up your way with thorns that people would use, you know, things you wouldn't want to get in. When I watch survival shows and they're in dangerous situations, I've seen them take and build their structure out of prickly stuff so that, you know, predators won't want to naturally come and get them, you know. So it doesn't say, again, what it is, but whatever it was. Again, it was for protection and a deterrent. So in some cases, the wall was solid stone and could additionally be protected by means of a head of thorns. 26, the vat under the wine press consisted of two tub-shaped cavities dug out from rock generally and connected by a trough. Grapes, or in the case of if they were using olives, these were the two primary pressed crops there, were placed in the upper cavity and trodden by foot, and the juice would run into the lower one when it was collected. That was one way they would do it. Another way they would do it was with a press, where they would literally use mechanical means to press the juice. It would run into that first vat and then run down and be collected in the collection area. But you can sort of envision how it must have worked. I mean, it's not hard whether they are stomping out the grapes in the wine vat or if they're using a mechanical press up here. You had this hollowed out area, then this trough that ran down to the bigger collection area where they would catch it in big vats and all of this. This was just designed to collect the initial juice and then funnel it to wherever it went. So there were two of these. 27, the tower was a fortified structure rising to considerable height, which was designed to observe the approach of hostile forces and to enable a watchman to see in every direction. And particularly, if you are in an environment where, you know, you've got a valuable crop and or people may want to tend to come and take advantage of it or exploit it, well, you need protection. And so you had the protection, obviously, of the fence at one level, but now here's an additional layer of security in that you can have a watchman who keeps, and again, the more you're on flat land during this, and obviously the best wines in the world are not built on anything that resembles flat land. But you don't often hear, you know, wines out of Israel getting 95 points or 100 from Parker. You never. So we're not talking about, you know, world category wine here, but certainly drinkable. So you want to protect it. Well, the tower was an additional layer to do that. It could also be used as a residence. See, somebody could actually live there, which was nice. But if you had a watchman, you probably worked in shifts, and you may even have had two guys living in there, depending upon your situation. And they could also store in the bottom of it, of course. They could use it as a storage place for their crops. Well, 28, the fact that the landowner was so diligent to provide more than one protection for the vineyard speaks of the great care and foresight that the owner possessed. 29, the Greek verb ekdidomi, literally to give from, is translated by the word rented, rented it out to vine growers. And again, you see that only part of this verse, it should be reflected in your Bible, is a quote from Isaiah, and part of it is not. Part of it is Jesus interjecting his own thoughts into the, or, you know, as the story goes. Some of it should be in caps and some should not. And then the rest of this is not in caps at all until you get down to verse 10 where he's clearly citing Scripture. So the rest of this just forms. He uses sort of Isaiah 5 as a jumping off point for his parable. And this is legitimate. I mean, this is a legitimate way to teach and to deal with things, that you might take a passage and use it as a jumping off point to make applications. As a matter of fact, a good example is that's what we did in the introduction. The passage of the conflict between Jesus and the leaders and the matter of authority and being a light in the world have very obvious applications even to our time in history. I made those applications. But that's just a jumping off point. And then the pastor, of course, now Jesus was a perfect communicator, but every pastor has to watch this when he uses a jumping off point to make some points to not get too far afield and to get right back to the text. And to deal with what he's trying to deal with. And one of the things you see here is while he introduces this verse as his jumping off point, he stays right with the context of the parable. He doesn't deviate until he's finished. And so that is a legitimate use of the Scripture here. So the Greek term rented was a commercial term for leasing. And Moulton and Milligan render the middle to let it out for my advantage. And that probably is the force of it. Because the middle voice in the Greek, in its strict middle voice, indicates that the person doing the action both participated in it and benefited from it at the same time. Or maybe not benefited, but had the results of the action as well. For instance, like the term, I wash, is always a middle. Because you're the one doing the washing, but you're also the one receiving the washing. So I rent means that I'm the one renting it out, but I'm also the one receiving the benefit from it. And there's a financial benefit in view. So 30, the rental amount was a specified portion of the crops, which the landowner could sell, bottle as wine, or even take cuttings and replant on another property. There were a number of types of contracts they had. Again, it wasn't always just for the wine. That might be it, but they may take the grapes and sell them elsewhere. Again, they may take off of the mature vines, some cuttings, and plant them and establish another vineyard. And again, all for their financial benefit. That's all it's for. So 31, the word translated vine owners is the Greek georgos, which was a general term for those involved in agriculture or gardening. 32, it was used of those that owned their own farms and ran their own operations. And it was also used of those that did agricultural work on a contract basis. So in this context, it is evident that tenant farmers are in view, that they're under a contract with the owner. 33, the last portion of verse 1 is the translation of the Greek verb apodemeo, which simply means to travel away from one's house or go on a journey. The term says nothing about the nature, purpose, or destination. It does not address how far the journey was or how long it was going to last. And again, the guy could have gone on a journey with the intention of returning. The guy could have gone on a journey because he's retired to Sarasota. And so he expects his, you know, crops, whatever, to be sent here. 35, only Luke's account adds any qualifying information. And he states that the owner embarked on a trip for a long time. In Luke chapter 20, verse 9, we get that one additional piece of information. That he planted it, went on a journey for a long time. The intention was he was not going to return quickly. At least according to Luke, we get that. Well, 36, his very absence would have eliminated any interaction with the tenants, who would then be free to administrate the enterprise as they saw fit. And that was normally expected to be the way it was going to be anyway. The landlord, the owner, recognized that, okay, these tenants, I'm going to lease it out to them, but I've got to leave it up to them. They're the ones that have to administrate this. And hopefully, you know, and this is why landlords do background checks. Matter of fact, we had a guy not all that long ago came in and wanted to rent a spot. I ran a background check on him. You know, he came in drunk at 9 in the morning, which was a real turnoff, or had been drinking. I mean, just smelled the booze, just reeked the booze. And so I'm thinking, would my boss want me to rent a space to this guy? Well, I called and checked on his references, and his references say, nope, he's slow pay, he doesn't pay, he's behind on his bills. Okay, he's drinking and behind on his bills. Do you want a lease to him? No. Absolutely not. I mean, I don't mind if you drink, but 9 in the morning's a little early. I mean, it's 5 somewhere, I'm sure, but still. And you don't show up. I mean, if I was going to try to rent a house, I don't think I would show up reeking of booze. I think that would be counterproductive to try to actually get a lease. This just shows you where people are in their thinking, the degeneration of society, the inability to even think logically. That is just not good. So, again, the interaction with the tenants, okay, once he does the lease, it's pretty much over. Same thing's still true for us today. I don't interact with the tenants any more than I have to. I mean, I'm not there to make them successful. I'm there to the extent that I can facilitate, but only within certain boundaries. It's not like my boss says, okay, well, I'm going to give you $1,000 a month to help the tenants. No, he doesn't do that, nor should he. The tenants have to do their own thing. Well, 37, the tenants could effectively ignore the owner, since he was a sufficient distance away as not to be any real threat to them, or so they thought. And maybe it looks like, well, he can't do anything, and that's exactly the idea they're going to get. He's too far away, he can't do anything, he won't do anything. Well, they're going to find out differently. Well, 38, the elements of the parable and their identification. A, the man is God the Father. B, the vineyard represents Israel, the nation that was to set an example for the nations in the proper worship of God. Deuteronomy 7, 6 through 8 explains exactly what God's intention was with regard to the nation. Not complicated, not hard to understand, really. He wanted Israel to be the light of the world, nationally. And this is the only nation, by the way, which God ever makes any kind of arrangement with at all. So any idea of client nations, priest nations, get all that out of your thinking. They don't exist. This is just verbiage that's been put in there by people who, for whatever reason, think they need to embellish on this. There is no other nation other than Israel in the Bible that God has said anything about, with one exception, and that exception is the church. The church is called a nation. But the USA is not God's representative. Neither is France, Germany, Russia, China, Bulgaria, or if it's still Bulgaria, I don't know, maybe it's Serbia now or something. All the stuff I learned as a kid has been changed. So none of these nations are set up by God at any level to represent God, except for Israel. Israel is unique in that regard. Verse 6, you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. There's never another time in any revelation where God says this to any other group other than Israel. Israel is his only nation. So if one wants to call them a priest nation, that's fine. But that's what they were supposed to be. A holy priesthood. A holy nation, a royal priesthood even, but they didn't succeed to that, as we're going to find out. Well, the church should. The Lord did not set his love on you or choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples. He would have picked the Chinese. For you were the fewest of all peoples, but because the Lord loved you and he kept the oath. So what is the basis for this covenant with Israel? It's the Abrahamic covenant. It's the covenants he'd made with the fathers. The oath which he swore to your forefathers. The Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Well, see, the provision of the wall and tower are designed to portray God's diligence and concern for the protection and preservation of the nation. Isaiah 31:5. Has God, as the landowner in this parable, has God fulfilled everything that you could ask of a tenant landlord? Yeah. He really has. I mean, this would be analogous today that I rent out a house to you, but I provide you free security alarm. That's not bad. That's $30 a month. If you know, I think are about that. Isaiah 31:5. Like flying birds, so the Lord of the armies will protect Jerusalem. He will protect it and deliver it. He will pass over and rescue it. And the whole point of all of this is God takes care of his nation. He doesn't just establish him and leave him alone, leave him at the mercy of everybody out there. God has been diligent about this. So D, these details demonstrate, that using this landlord-tenant analogy, that God had done everything in his power to make Israel a spiritual success. See, E here, the tenants represent the unbelieving religious establishment over the course of Israel's existence, culminating with the current religious leadership in Israel. The emphasis is on them. But were there other periods in Israel's history where they also had bad religious leaders who were abusing the vineyard? Yeah. Yeah, there were. Who were not cooperating with the terms of the original agreement. Well, F, these men were responsible for teaching the people. So both they and the people could produce divine good. Ezekiel 44:23. So what's the ideal here? God's looking for fruit. Well, what does God deem to be fruit? Well, he wants them to understand spiritual issues and to apply these things, but these cannot be applied unless they're taught. People can't be expected to know or learn these from their youth. They've got to be instructed. Moreover, they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the profane, and cause them to discern between the clean and the unclean. In a dispute, they shall take their stand as judges, but they will judge according to my ordinances. They will also keep my laws, my statutes, and all my appointed feasts, and sanctify my Sabbaths. So again, why teach? So people can get the information that leads to production. G, the fact that the landowner departs on an extended journey relates to the fact that the manifestations of God, which began with the Exodus and the establishment of the nation, were so numerous in the Old Testament, and especially when the temple was dedicated, had almost completely ceased. There had been no manifestations, no divine manifestations of miracles and God's presence in Israel for some time. There had been no prophetic voice in Israel for over 400 years, almost 450 years, prior to John the Baptist. So essentially, God establishes this, then apparently departs. Well, this relates to God's aloofness, obviously, his transcendence as he lives in heaven, and essentially leaves the nation to do what he's told them to do. Well, 1 Kings 8:10-12 gives us one very clear and good manifestation of the divine essence. But this was at the time, the last real big manifestation was under the time of Solomon. 8:10-12. And it happened that when the priest came from the holy place, the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord. Well, it's not like this happened every week after that, or every month or every year. It didn't happen again. It's never recorded that it happened again. This was the last real manifestation. I mean, we'd had a lot of manifestations of God and miracles and all that. Doesn't mean that all miracles ceased. There were still some isolated spots here and there. But largely speaking, it appears that God planted the nation and walked off. But, I mean, obviously he didn't. Then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick cloud. And the Lord essentially manifests himself there in that. I was going to try to get through this, but we're out of time. So we'll just wrap these two last points up quickly when we resume next week and be ready to move on with our next verse. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.